Hello and welcome to Beat Cafe, a weekly program sponsored by Offbeat Magazine that explores the music scene in New Orleans and the broader reach of Louisiana. I'm David Johnson, editor at Offbeat and host of this program. Offbeat is a proud supporter of WHIV 102.3 FM. I encourage you to visit offbeat.com to read our new July 2022 digital edition, featuring a cover story about country singer-songwriter Shawn Williams, who discusses her fourth album, titled Wallowing in the Night. You'll also find interviews with Ricky Money of Preservation Hall, hip-hop artist Crucial, studio producer Scott Billington, and Cajun musician Joe L. Saunier, just to name a few of the subjects of the feature stories. Check out our album reviews, live music listings, original photos, and videos at offbeat.com, and follow us on social media at Offbeat Magazine. On today's episode, I will be joined by Big Chief Shaka Zulu of the Golden Feather Hunters, Black Masking Indian Tribe. He is a master of the beaded and feathered suit-making tradition, unique to this cultural practice, that draws from both indigenous and African traditions in New Orleans. Chief Shaka is also revered as a drummer and a stilt dancer. He was recently named a National Heritage Fellow by the National Endowment for the Arts, the highest award bestowed upon artists in the United States. We'll talk about this prestigious award, his mentors, and his views about the role of Black Masking Indians in the 21st century. In the second half hour, I will interview Jeremy Williams. He is the band director at Marrero Middle School and faced tremendous challenges following damage to the school and the ruin of many music instruments for his students following Hurricane Ida in August of 2021. Yet, through sheer determination and the generosity of donors, Jeremy was able to make his band whole again. Jeremy has also taken on a larger role as director of the Next Generation Jazz Band, a group of nearly 40 young musicians from grades 6 through 12, drawn from across Metro New Orleans, who are performing with the likes of such professional jazz musicians as Wendell Brunius, Kevin Lewis, Joe Lasty, Lewis Ford, Mark Mullins, Craig Klein, and many others. The Next Generation Jazz Band recently recorded an album at the New Orleans Jazz Museum, and we'll hear a sneak preview of one of the songs, the classic, Just a Closer Walk with Thee. Thrilled today to be joined by Chief Shaka Zulu of the Golden Feather Hunters. He has been recently named a National Heritage Fellow by the National Endowment for the Arts, which is the highest honor our nation bestows upon artists in the United States. So welcome, Shaka. I'm so happy to have you here.
Oh, man, it's glad to be here. Thanks for having me.
Well, especially on the heels of such a great honor. Tell me, how did you get nominated for this? I'm curious to know what the process was.
I wasn't quite sure what the process was, but I was actually working with a well-renowned storyteller. She specialized in many stories with Aesop fables. I was her percussionist, and we toured the whole East Coast. She's actually from North Philly, but she lives in Willingboro, Jersey. And her name is Queen Noor. Wonderful person, great body of work. And I think we did probably a couple hundred libraries in the whole East Coast, New York, Connecticut. And, you know, we were all around. And she's a member of Theater Works. So she nominated me. And I found out probably a little bit later because she wanted it to be a surprise, which I think is the best way to do it. But she kept asking me a lot of questions about my work and the history of my work. So I thought that was unusual. But since we were great friends and we worked together for such a long time, I thought it was appropriate to give her the answers. But she's the one who nominated.
Again, it was done by surprise. She was kind of pulling all this information out of you, little knowing that it would lead to such an incredible honor. So let's talk about the Black Masking Indian tradition. Of course, you've been involved through your family. Obviously, this has been a generational thing for you. I'm curious to know when you first started masking it.
I started later. Being a percussionist, African percussionist, I was actually doing the music. You know, I was a drummer. Started with Big Chief Smiley Ricks, who he's living out of town now. But he had a group called Indians of the Nation, which was very genius. He brought together a lot of chiefs from different nations, and he wanted to do a music project. Since he was Dr. John's percussionist anyway. He was already on the music scene, and he wanted to do a music project because he thought that the music of the tradition was so profound. And so we did that. I did some drum tracks on the second album. I think he did an album before that that I wasn't part of, but the second one, I did some drum tracks on that. That became a very, very good album. To this day, I think that's one of my favorites.
What's that album?
It's called Feathercraft, but it's Indians of the Nation. I haven't seen it in a while, but I don't have a CD player to listen to it like I used to. And I'm not tech savvy, so it's not on my phone.
I'm sure it's out there somewhere.
But anyway, after that, you know, I have been watching the Indians for a long time because my great-grandmother, Inez Chanu, she used to live on right down the street from Rose Funeral Home on Claiborne. So during Carnival Day, our parents used to drop all the kids off to her. And we used to get a chance to run down the street, catch the Indians under the bridge, you know. So I grew up watching all of the 6 and 7 war Indians. My favorite was Yellow Pocahontas, you know, watching Tootie and Darryl and the whole crew. And I had two great uncles who masked, which I kind of found out later that they were related to me. But I had remember coming up seeing, because they all were from the same area. So eventually, Smiley moved out of town. And I remember wanting to actually mask. And it was a no-brainer because I was coming from a masking tradition anyway, which is the still dance tradition that I had been doing for quite some time. So why not go into the natural phase of masking as it relates to New Orleans culture?
So, of course, you just mentioned that you are a stilt dancer, an incredible skill. I'm always in awe anytime I see anybody up there doing that. How did you learn that tradition?
I actually was fortunate to grow up in it. My dad, Zohar Israel, he was a stilt dancer from the African and Caribbean tradition, which is quite different than stilt walking. One is the mask and the other is a person. One is an entity that represents a ancestral spirit or the entity of what it is, the reason that they're coming out with. And the other one is pretty surface. So there's no such thing as stilt walking in African and Caribbean tradition. It was always the dance of the mask. So my dad was, he had a performing arts company. So I kind of grew up in that, which is, you know, I'm blessed because I didn't really know much else, even though I played sports too. So that's how I got into stilt dancing. When I went away to college and came back, he had already been touring. So I just jumped right into touring mode and was able to make a living off it, which is, can't get no better than that.
You have such a unique skill. So I have to ask, you know, the notion of doing this, you know, it takes, in my opinion, quite a lot of bravery to get up there and to be able to move with such agility. Is it something where you have to kind of do it as much mental as you do physical in learning that?
It's
that
really tradition? The unique thing about it is you can't teach balance. It's an innate skill. Either you have it or you don't. But it's just rules, a few rules that you have to follow. It's really about the discipline of following those rules. You know, you can't master, it's something that you can't master. No matter how good you get at it, the chances of you falling is always there. It's just one of those things. So it's a humbling experience. Once you 14 feet in the air, you really at a disadvantage. And you understand that quite well. But it's really the adrenaline and the audience that dictates the success of what it is that you're doing at that particular time. So it's something that's very easy to fall in love with because there's not many of us around the country that's practicing that tradition.
True, and especially with the African element as well. Now, you've been to Africa. You've performed there as well, and
yes,
you've been engaged in ceremonies.
I try to go there every year. One is bloodline. Two is it gives me a lot of inspiration. My mentor said one thing to me. He said, when you leave the country, it's equivalent to reading 10 books. I used to like to read, so I don't like to read anymore. I like audio books now. I try to leave the country to get that education.
It is. It's a full immersion education. Obviously, where in Africa have you traveled?
North, south, east, west, and the border of Central. Mm-hmm. I've been as far north as Morocco, South Africa, border of Congo, east Tanzania, and west Nigeria. We just come back from Sierra Leone, which was a very interesting place on the West Coast. So I try to get all perspectives, you know, north, south, east, west, and central, to make sure that I'm well equipped with the overall view of the continent of Africa.
A vast continent,
yes.
Obviously, with many, many, many cultures.
Each part is very different.
Yes, indeed. Going back to the Black masking tradition. You were among those who helped redefine the terminology we use. It had often been called Mardi Gras Indians. Now we hear it more commonly referred to as Black masking Indians. Tell me how that thought process came to be.
It's probably, I always say it's, I heard Donald Harrison Jr. say something that was very important. He said, Afro New Orleans music and culture. I was like, wow, that's profound. Because when you, the origin of something, it takes you have to be very courageous to make sure you own it. And owning it sometimes is oral tradition. It's not always documented. And the danger in oral tradition is people may document for you and that documentation doesn't have to be accurate. So you want to do both. I think that's the new revolution, to have oral traditions to bring down to the youth and also to document. Because for many years, African tradition was oral tradition. So the term was very, very interesting because one of the things you know about Louisiana culture as it relates to minorities, or should I say Black folk, and I don't want to use the term minority because we was always the majority since yes. The inception of this city. We wasn't a part of America yet. You know, there has 100 years ships were going in different parts of what we call America before 1719, when the first ships from the continent of Africa arrived to this place that we call Louisiana or New Orleans, should I say. So my question is, one, not all of us got here through the slave trade. There were African people present here many years before that in other parts of the world as well. Two, for that 100 years of us being present here before we was a part of America, and they had been in other parts of America 100 years prior to that, you saying that the folk here didn't have a culture.
That's a very good point.
Yeah. So now, what was that culture?
It can get very tricky when we try to define a region.
So what was that culture? And we know in this being a port city, we always had free people of color, which is another term. So people have a culture. You're born with it. So when we saying that we're paying homage to the Native Americans, one, Louisiana wasn't America yet. Two, when you say Native American, who are you really talking about? So basically, who are we paying homage to? So you just got to go back. Every nation want to be called by their nation name, especially when America was brought to them. You know, they didn't come to America. And two, you had two nations of folk that was indigenous to this land. One took a number, went to the Reds, the Trail of Tears, and gave up the land. Then you had folk who fought for the land, still live on the land, still had the original land patents to the land. So when 1719 happened, the Africans that came here that rebelled and ran off into the Maroons with those indigenous folk, that's the folk that they ran into the Maroons with, right?
Yes.
So one was called civilized because they gave the land up. The others were just indigenous that fought for the land. So when they ran into the Maroons, those are the folk we were paying homage to, which is a great way of putting all of the pieces together. So the way that we paid homage was to create this tradition. Because then you started saying Mardi Gras Indian. We had nothing to do with Mardi Gras. I wasn't even allowed as a Black person to do Mardi Gras with Europeans. So that term doesn't apply. The other was Indian. That was a name that was given to indigenous folk of the land. So it got a little tricky to where, what do you really call yourselves? You know, so I thought that Black masking tradition was more appropriate. So folks started really coming together and saying that term is probably the most appropriate to what it is that we're doing. And it's still growing. To be honest, I don't have an issue with Mardi Gras. It's just that for some people, that's what they want to be called. For me, I just chose to identify as something different.
And we'll take a brief break, a pause for the cause here on WHIV 102.3, and I will be back with Chief Shaka Zulu.
The vibe of the city for human rights and social justice, WHIV 102.3 FM.
And we're back with Beat Cafe. I'm David Johnson, host of this program. I'm here today with Black Masking Indian Chief Shaka Zulu, who has recently been honored as a National Heritage Fellow by the National Endowment for the Arts, the highest honor our nation bestows upon artists. Of course, Masking Indian is very much a very labor-intensive art, to say the least. I'm curious to know, when you put your suit together, what is your creative process? What do you take into account as you're as you're making this amazing creation?
Well, it's a year-long process, first of all. It has to involve self-incarceration.
Yes, extreme discipline. Yeah. Yes.
If you want to be on that level of soaring, you know, when once you become a chief, you know, it gets to that point if you want to be recognized for what the culture really is about, which is the soaring, the work that you put in. It was easy for me to create my own niche in this culture because I had come from a culture of mask and stilt dancing where you are not a person, you're an entity. You become an entity of what it is that you're masking. So for me, I just brought that culture into this New Orleans masking culture tradition. So it had to be entity-based for me because the suit tells a story. And the question is, what story you want to tell? So me being versed and well-traveled in on the continent of Africa, understanding that that's the majority part of my DNA, if not all of it, I wanted to put focus on that. You know, I wanted to tell that story because that's the hidden voice that people usually don't get to hear once the origin of a tradition began outside of the continent of Africa. So even though that history could be an African tradition. So I just focused on every suit having something to do with either Africa or something that I'm passionate about. You know, I did a honeybee suit. I was trying to bring attention to, you know, the spraying of the plants. So the bees is unhealthy because they can't really, you know, do what they do naturally.
Right. Strong environmentalism theme, yeah.
Yeah, so environment is very important to me. Spiritual, social, economic, all of that's important. And physical. I did a toucan bird suit because people are buying them as pets and there's not many of them left. I did that suit in Tanzania, by the way. Hmm. You know, in the rainforest. So, you know, so it's something that I bring attention to. Every other suit has been either me wearing a mask or the theme of that suit had something to do with African tradition. So I would take a month and travel. I try to travel to the place to get more insight on so the suit can be more meaningful. Like this year, I didn't get to go to Egypt because I had never been, but I had a Kemet suit, Egyptian suit, basically. Mm. But my wife just came back, Naima Zulu. She just came out of temples and tombs and those places, the pyramids. And so I was able to get a lot of knowledge and information from her on the suit. So every suit that I do is going to be based on African diaspora as it relates to the Caribbean. Also something that I'm passionate about that I want to bring attention to.
Now there's often, you know, a difference between uptown Indians and downtown Indians in their artistry and the pattern design. How about you just tell our listeners what that historically has been?
And it's really not where you live, it's where you're from or who you learn from. I'm from the Ninth Ward, which is downtown, so it's quite natural. I learned everything pretty much downtown style of sewing from Big Chief Dow Montana, Yellow Pocahontas, because I was in that nation or gang for a while, probably 18 years before I started Golden Feather Hunts. Their thing was based on his father, which was a Lathera. You know, he did a lot of the framework for the architecture that you see on the building, crown moldings and all that stuff. So in my opinion, I think he just incorporated what he mastered into that masking art form. So his stuff was always three-dimensional. He called his work designs and not patches like they do uptown. He used a lot of sequin in his work. His theme is, you know, he called it soft sculpture sometimes, but the theme was always designs, or it probably had some type of Caribbean or African theme. And I think the whole sequin thing is really a Caribbean thing. In my opinion, who are doing sequin in this way back in the day? And you got to say on the island of Hispaniola,
oh, yes,
which we call Haiti today. So, because if we look at their flags, the drapo, people say Vevé, but they're actually the symbols in the flag. And I understand the Haitian Revolution and Louisiana Purchase were connected. So you got to make the connection. There's no other way. So that work is different. And we wear the turkey feathers that we call quills. And I think everybody did at one point. And uptown, their thing is mainly just draw a picture on canvas and bead that picture. So that suit tells a story as well. There's a theme to it. They call it work patches. They don't call it designs. We have a lot of marabou around the piece. they use the velvet around the piece. Most of the time, they use a lot of native theme in their suits. And they wear the ostrich feathers, which is an African bird, by the way. They call plumes. So once again, you know, because you're downtown on me, you don't sew flat. It's just, you know, who you learn from. You don't see too many people sewing three-dimensional uptown. You might have, a couple people. But I don't think no style is going to save you time, you know, because I've sewn an all beaded suit before, and I used to think that it was easier, and that's not the case. So you're not going to save time no matter what style you use. But that's the difference in how we sew to people that's really actually looking at the suits. And you can determine whether a person is uptown style or downtown style. So.
Yeah, it's fascinating how this tradition, you know, incorporated so many, like you said, influences that came from afar, and that it kind of developed on two different tracks, even in, you know, one municipality. I'm curious to ask you about what you think of the tradition at this point. Of course, Mardi Gras Indian tradition goes back quite deep into our history. It has evolved like all traditions do. Where would you say it's at this point? Is it a really healthy, thriving tradition? Are there areas that maybe you have concerns about?
I think it's healthy only because it's still alive. What I love about museums versus galleries, museum is basically about history that's not alive. It's the past. And galleries it represents living art to me. So the culture is still alive. So if something is alive, whether it's healthy or not, it's alive. So I look at this tradition the same way. It's still alive. And I was involved in experienced this thing called Katrina. And when I left during Katrina to go to Atlanta, before that, I was very concerned about the health of the tradition until Katrina happened. And I couldn't really sew in Atlanta. I used to have to come back to New Orleans. I had a good friend, Marcel, that had a house here. We used to come to his house on Ursuline Street and sew. So I used to make special trips down here just for that because I could not get into sewing in Atlanta. That's when I realized how delicate this tradition was. And so I had a different take on it once I got back. I am concerned a little bit about culture, and two concerns I have. One is, if you want something to last culturally, you have to teach it to children. So you don't see as many children as you used to. That's a concern. The other is, the thing about tradition is, it doesn't have room for innovation, usually. In my opinion, that's another tradition killer. So I'm concerned about the lack of innovation. Not to say that I wanted to turn it to something else, but it has to have some room for it in order for it to stay alive. So those are mainly the two concerns that I have. But what I do see that's healthy is people are excited about the tradition. People are learning more about the history of the tradition. People are being more bold with creating their space and their place and their positions in the tradition. And you do start to see some women involved. And when you bring in women, of course, that's the birth of many things in a positive direction to come. And also, people are traveling more with the tradition. You know, you got exhibits going to Europe. You have exhibits. Then it was a great thing that it became a part of the music tradition, because those guys, Chief Jolly and Donald Harrison Jr. and Senior and Sharice Harris and Brian Nelson, and when they started traveling and Wild Chapatulas and Wild Magnolias and Chief Bo Dollars, I think that was a great thing, because one thing to have it orally, but people want to have visuals to what it is that these guys were talking about. I thought that was a revolutionary thing to do, to stop destroying the suits and keeping them and traveling with them. To now, you can actually take those suits and go do exhibits, and people know exactly what you're talking about. And it doesn't have to always have anything to do with the music. So I thought that was something that was very important in history that doesn't get a lot of attention. First crew of guys like the Neville brothers and all of those folk who just went out to the world and brought a little piece of that culture with them, so people can have an easy transition as it relates to bringing that culture around the world.
Well, it's very true. You know, this tradition has gone, you know, from the streets of New Orleans to a global stage in so many ways. I'm curious, whenever you bring your suits, let's say, especially to Africa, what is the reaction there? What are they surprised to see that something like this is going on in the United States, or what's the general impression?
I think my family have a strategy of visiting a place in Africa first and do the introduction, do the lectures and all that stuff before you actually bring it. I thought that was a good strategy. So when I do bring a suit there, one, I can't bring the headpieces because they're so huge and you can't travel.
Hard to travel,
so I have
right?
to make a rendition of it in terms of the headpiece to bring over there. The other part is you go over there with other missions and then incorporate the cultural part into that mission. But what we found was everywhere we went, we realized that beads and feathers is not a Native American thing. You know, Africans, not just a Native American thing, should I say. Let me rephrase that. Africans have been wearing beads and feathers since the beginning of their tradition as well. So that's a universal thing as it relates to culture. The Yoruba style of beading is very, very old. The Indibele, Maasai, all that's very, very old beading traditions. The feathers that they wear in their heads, the Congo and the masquerades and all of that stuff, very, very old. So the connection was more difficult for us being brought up in the Americas than it was for the Africans to understand, because they already knew that it had always been in their culture. So when they see it, they immediately make the connections.
Of course.
So it's a very easy transition. And the other way we did it, you know, like we just left Sierra Leone and my wife is in healthcare, Naima. Her mission was doing pop-up clinics. She's in public health. That's her field. So she's always wanted to do that internationally. So we went there with a good partner of hers who runs a school. She assisted with the school and put together the health piece. But the beautiful thing was we took the whole health piece with the pop-up clinics, and it was a Tim Sid idea was to do a children's festival or a youth festival there. So we wind up incorporating stilts, you know, and all of that stuff. So we were able to put together a festival that was very well attended and well done in a very short period of time. So we try to do that same formula all over Africa. At least that's the intention. I think that's something that's going to be healthy for New Orleans because it's bringing New Orleans culture. And it's also making a connection with New Orleans culture and how African it is, since the narrative is New Orleans is the most African city anyway.
Absolutely. I don't think anybody would argue with that. I want to thank you so much for joining me today. And I'm going to let all of our listeners know that a video has been filmed of Chief Shaka that will be on the National Endowment for the Arts website later this year. And of course, we will be publicizing that on offbeat.com as well. Thank you so much, Shaka. I really appreciate it.
It's my pleasure.
Thank you.
We've got you covered, New Orleans. WHIV-FM and streaming 24/7 at WHIVFM.org. WHIV-LP 102.3 FM, New Orleans.
Hello, I'm David Johnson, and welcome to Beat Cafe. We're back for our second half hour, and today I'm thrilled to be joined by Jeremy Williams. He is the music director at Marrero Middle School here in suburban New Orleans, and he is also recently taken on a new project of directing the Next Generation Jazz Band. And we'll hear all about that. I was recently privileged to hear a recording session by this band. So welcome, Jeremy. Glad to have you here today.
Welcome, welcome. Thanks for having me.
Absolutely. So Jeremy, Next Generation Jazz Band, tell us all about this group.
Roughly about a year ago, I did a job here at the New Orleans Jazz Museum with the director, Greg Lambuzzi. After that, Greg and I had discussed potentially doing a recording project with some young kids in the area. And the project kind of shifted directions a few different times between COVID and various hurricanes. Hurricane Ida came and hit, and that kind of pushed some things back and things like that. As you guys heard, I am already the director at Marrero Middle School. At one point, the idea was to have kids from the Marrero band making a recording, and then Ida came along and basically wiped the band out temporarily, because we will be back again in August. but they wiped us out because the room got basically destroyed from water and mold and mildew. Then when all of that happened, Greg and I kept in contact. We kind of shifted gears. From there, basically, I put together a group of all local kids from roughly around the sixth grade through the 12th grade. From there, we basically went last week, and then the week before, we put together a 11-track all New Orleans CD that we'll be putting out. Basically, every single song, we wanted to make sure that we were keeping the local music and local musicians alive. So all of the songs are local songs like Big Chief, Tutti Ma Is a Big Fine Thing, various different ones like Bourbon Street Parade. And a lot of these songs, some of the kids knew them, but a lot of them, they might have heard them, but they didn't actually know the tunes because we've never been in depth like that. So it was a perfect time for us to be able to keep the local music alive and going.
And this is a big band. I mean, literally, like in the old-fashioned sense of a big band. How many musicians are in this band?
Roughly 40 kids. And many people told me that I was nuts for doing it like that because it would have been, the project would have been so much easier if I would have simply just said, you know what, let me just go pick all of these kids that, one, already know how to play everything because they're just, you know, good young musicians. And then two, if you just pick, you know, enough for maybe a combo, it's just so much easier to put the group together, especially for scheduling purposes. You know, when you go from like, say, 5 to 7 people to, say, 40, I mean, I'm sure you can imagine the scheduling chaos that goes on to try to make that happen. But I intentionally chose to have more kids and intentionally chose to have kids from various different levels, because we wanted the experience to be able to be felt for years to come. Like, there's so many resources that have been put together to make this happen that we wanted to share it with as many people as possible. So by having kids in the younger grades, like 6th, 7th, even 8th grade, those kids, the local area will be able to feel the effects of this experience for years to come. But they also were able to get, you know, assistance from some of the older kids who were in high school, and then some of the older high school kids, you know, they were able to get some great mentorship along with the younger kids. We were able to bring in some local musicians. I mean, there's a whole slew. Even up to the day of recording, we had people who were just walking by. I just asked them. I saw them there. I was like, do you want to join us for a tune? And we're not talking about like random street musicians here. We're talking about prominent people. Like some of the people who, you know, we're talking about, we have Jeff Albert on trombone. We have Craig Klein on trombone, which, I mean, I'm sure most of the listeners know that Craig played with Harry Connick Jr.'s big band for years and years. He plays with Bonorama. You know, he plays with the New Orleans Nightcrawlers. So these
Grammy
are
Grammy Award winner.
Yeah, yes. I mean, he's a Grammy Award winner. These are just prominent musicians. Some of the other guys, quite a few of them came from Preservation Hall. We had, let's see, Joe Lasty on drums. We had Lewis Ford, Shannon Powell, the great Shannon Powell on drums. I mean, you can never go wrong with these guys. And then my favorites, one of my very favorites that came out was Mr. Wendell Brunius. Mr. Wendell Brunius was an absolute treasure for this project because, you know, you only think you know about jazz and local jazz in particular when you do a project like this. But then when you bring somebody in like that, he came in first rehearsal and he just started like completely dissecting and reworking things that this is the way it is on the paper. You know, anybody can read the music. You know, I can teach anybody to read the black and white. But Wendell, with his, 50 years or more of experience of playing this, specifically this music, to see him work with the kids. And the best part about Wendell was is that he never held back with anything. He was super generous with his time and his knowledge. It was never a doubt, does he know what's going on? Absolutely not. We're talking about living legend in the area who just was so generous with his time. And I mean, like, one of the songs, like Tootie Ma is a big fun thing. Wendell was literally playing on the original record with Danny Barker when he recorded that. So to have somebody like Wendell come in and work with the kids on a tune like that, money cannot buy things like that. That's just personal experience that he's just literally just sharing with the kids. And it's strictly for one purpose. And I believe the reason that this partnership worked so well with Wendell was because we both shared the same mission of 100% doing this to pass the music on to the next generation.
Yeah, it's amazing. I mean, like you said, you're nurturing this whole new generation of jazz artists. It's not just, you know, strictly a moment in time, but something that will hopefully, like you said, cast seeds and blossom into the future. What led to your strong interest in New Orleans traditional jazz and, of course, just the New Orleans sound? What's your background in all of this?
My background, like when I was growing up, like this is another thing that really made it super special for me. I've always loved the New Orleans music and I always thought that you should be, each area of the world has its own things that just kind of define what it is and who it is. We all know that everyone comes here for basically two things. Well, maybe three, you know. They come here for the food, the music, and Mardi Gras. But the music is always there. So who else should be playing the music from here than the people who live here? You know, and I really try to preach that even in my own classroom when you might have kids that are just coming in as sixth graders that have never played, but we will play tunes from here that, you know, at first, some of them are very resistant because they're like, you know, what is that? Those are old tunes. We don't want to play stuff like that. You know, you'd be playing like St. James and just various different tunes, like Just a Closer Walk. Oh, that's old stuff. That's for church. Then when they start hearing people, you know, like Wendell and Lewis Ford and Joe Lesty, and like, they hear where it can be. That's when it really kind of kicks in and turns on and it just excites them. It's not, I mean, it is old music, but the old music is what brought us to where we are today. So that's why we should be trying to preserve that.
Yeah, it's timeless music.
Absolutely.
Is what I would say. It never goes out of style. And it's always good to know that a future generation is being exposed to it and very much perpetuating it into the future. So I'm going to go back again. How did you recruit the members of this band? How did this assembly of 40 students, like you said, from a reasonably wide age range, but all a school age, how did that come to be?
So some of the kids were from my class. Like I had taught these kids maybe previously, and maybe they went on to high school now. There's a number of those kids. And then there's a number of kids who maybe are privately taught before, maybe currently, or even in the past. There's some other kids with me working with the local honor jazz bands with LMEA. Some of those kids I've, you know, just kind of learned who they were and learned their playing just from hearing them working those events. And then some of the other ones, I was literally just at various different events. You know, they've had various festivals here at the Jazz Museum. Some of them were affiliated with the Jazz and Heritage Festival. And like, I just go to some of these festivals and I'll hear people, like there's a couple kids in particular who they actually are not even that far from my school, but I've never even heard them before for whatever reason, whether it was just they were never exposed to the right place or they didn't have the resources or whatever it may be. And I can distinctively remember looking at my wife saying, you know, I'm still trying to get two more saxophones. I said, listen to him right there. He will fit for this project. I've literally just walked up to him and said, what are you doing in June? Because I'm working on a project and your sound and what you're playing would fit this project perfectly. Are you interested? So, I mean, this is real life stuff. That's how it works in like in a musician world. People will hear something. They might hear a drummer. That's the feel I've been looking for. And just walk up to them, here's my card, give me a call, because trying to cut a record, are you interested?
That's great.
That's the way it works.
You're literally a talent scout out there in the scene, you know, with a fine-tuned ear for these things. Let's go back and talk about Hurricane Ida, of course, because that was such a blow to so many. You mentioned, of course, that Marrero Middle School, your performance room for the band, was heavily damaged, and you lost most of the instruments, as I understand. How'd you go about rebuilding?
That was a super, super extensive process. You know, when you're trying to replace one or two instruments, you know, that's relatively easy after an event like that. But when you're trying to replace an entire fleet, like complete inventory of instruments for a band, that was rather difficult. So some of the things that I've done is I've written multiple grants, plain old fashioned regular fundraisers that you would do anywhere else. You know, I have a lot of partnerships throughout the city and even nationally. I've had various different people, you know, some of the bigger organizations like the Guitar Center Foundation, Save the Music, VH1. There's so many of them that have just stepped in. Most of them from the very beginning, when, you know, they learned a story, they would say, you know, I can help this much, but we're really not in a position to be able to fill that gap for the entire group. And before a lot of them would even go to there, I would actually tell them that I'm not looking for anyone to try and replace the entire inventory. Because when you have such loss like that, that's basically impossible for one organization to be able to do something like that. Because, I mean, you're talking about thousands and thousands of dollars. Like, even one instrument nowadays can be $3,000-$4,000.
Wow.
That's why, I mean, a lot of times you see some of these cheaper instruments now at some of these local stores, like even Walmart. I know, I mean, like, it sounds ridiculous, but they sell some of these trumpets and clarinets, which organizations like that, they do not usually like to donate things like that, because there's a reason why some of these things are cheaper, because they either don't last or you can't replace them like whenever the things get broken and stuff like that. So these organizations, when they step in, they're donating, but they're also donating quality stuff that's going to be there for the long haul, because nobody ever wants to have to do this, you know, a couple of times.
Well, it speaks deeply to your dedication as an educator, because it's tough enough to show up every day to teach kids, but to go out and have to raise money after such a devastating experience, that is remarkable. We're going to take a brief pause for the cause to our station identification here at WHIV 102.3, and I will be back with Jeremy Williams.
We've got you covered, New Orleans, WHIV-FM, and streaming 24/7 at WHIVFM.org, WHIV-LP 102.3 FM, New Orleans.
And we're back with Beat Cafe. I'm David Johnson. I am joined today by Jeremy Williams, who is the band director at Marrero Middle School. And we've been discussing a larger project he has taken on called the Next Generation Jazz Band that I had the privilege of hearing here at the New Orleans Jazz Museum. That's where Offbeat is headquartered. They are recording an album. So, Jeremy, you know, obviously you have built a strong partnership here with the New Orleans Jazz Museum. How important is it for educators to have a resource like this?
Oh, this is absolutely vital in order for something to be able to, you know, survive within the local area. You have to have feeders out in the community that are willing to support, not even just financially, but to be able to offer opportunities. You know, you turn on the TV, you see these different guys playing, and like with anything, it doesn't matter if you're playing music or sports. If you are not nurturing those things when the kids are younger, then eventually with time, things start to disappear. And you can see that very evidently here, specifically with music education and jazz education. Multiple people say that they love jazz and they want to support it and things like that. But at the end of the day, the things that really show are offering people opportunities to play and, you know, financial resources. And even if you can't do those things, volunteering to be able to put something together, some type of project, you know, things like that. There are always ways to be able to support education and jazz education in the area. I mean, there's so many festivals, so many different opportunities. It's just that the resources have to be there. Specifically for us with this project, you know, the partnership with the New Orleans Jazz Museum, I mean, it's just been a godsend. So relatively recently, the museum started the jazz, what is it, the Ruth U. Fertel Jazz Lab and the Education Center. So both of those components are underneath the umbrella of the museum. And so the Education Center is set up for kids to be able to come in and kind of do outreach in the neighborhood, specifically with jazz education. And then you got the Ruth U. Fertel Jazz Lab, which has very recently been set in place to where, you know, basically to offer opportunities like this. So we are essentially the first product to be able to come through and be produced through the Ruth U. Fertel Jazz Lab. And I mean, this has been an absolute honor for me and for the kids. As soon as we were done recording, I had kids coming up to me, when can we hear the album? When is it going to be available? And in what capacity? You know, people, these kids are ready to get out there and make $1 million, you know? But, you know, as I told them that this is another life lesson. Things like this in this business, they take time, they take resources. You know, after the recording is over, there's a number of procedures and just there's a whole process where things have to go through in order for it to be put out there if you want it to be done correctly.
Well, that's great. I mean, the kids are learning not only the art and the fun of performance, but of course the discipline that's required, the patience that's required, and all of the things, of course, that happen out of sight, you know, whenever you're polishing an album. In fact, I got to, when I stepped up there to hear you all play, you were doing Go to the Mardi Gras, which I consider a very complicated song. It was amazing to hear all of these components of that song coming together. And yes, it's great to see that the Jazz Education Center, which is a new branch here at the Jazz Museum, is being put to such good use. How did you come to meet Greg Lambusi, the director here?
There was a education conference that came. It was a virtual conference in June of 2021. And it was ISTE, which is an education technology outreach conference. And they were virtual because basically the world was somewhat relatively still on the lockdown from COVID. And so they didn't want to have a conference in place. They reached out to Greg and they were looking for a group of young student musicians that would be able to play local music. And so essentially the idea was the group of students that would be playing would be their way of announcing where the conference would be for the next year, which would be this year. So 2022, June, into July, it was the ISTE conference here. And when they came in town, we actually played again at their conference. Many of the same kids and many more were added, because it went from when we played here originally, I would say probably about 15 kids probably participated in that event. And then from there, we jumped to probably almost 40 kids.
Oh, it's so impressive. Do the kids learn about the history of jazz as they're performing?
Oh, yeah. We brought in, you know, like every time I brought in a new piece, you know, we just kind of discussed some of that and what the purpose of it was and who was it originally that, you know, had recorded that. That was one of the biggest things I had tried to encourage kids to do, was just try to listen. Because you can go read it all in a book, but go listen to what was Professor Longhair doing? Where is he at in the timeline of things? And then, you know, specifically for us, you know, it was, like I had mentioned, it's an absolute treasure to be able to bring in people like Wendell, because Wendell, he was not really preaching. He was just telling his story, and that was the history. He was the living history. So, you know, you can read it again all in a book, but when you're hearing the story firsthand from, you know, one man who literally lived it, you know, that's no book can tell you that.
So by the time this recording is finished, how will people be able to access it?
We are working on that right now because there are a number of factors of various different things. The kids will definitely be getting a copy of it for sure with their families. And I'm sure it'll probably be available on the database. You know, the museum has this mega database of just so many recordings that people can go on and listen to. I'm sure that will be another resource. We're exploring options for putting it out further into the community so that way everyone will be able to hear it. But I mean, as you know, there's a number of even legal things that go with that.
Yes, yes. That's another element of education, of course, in music. You know, obviously I can tell you're very, very passionate about what you do. What is it about being an educator, especially in music, that has so motivated you?
Specifically for me, with my journey, I would say, you know, when I grew up, not one time in my life did I feel like, you know, I was shortchanged or, you know, I didn't get that opportunity because, you know, I didn't have the resources or anything like that. Not because, you know, when I was growing up, we were rich by any means, because we were certainly not rich. It was just that my parents instilled into us, because we literally saw them doing exactly what is supposed to be being done. And what I mean by that is, you know, my dad, he would work ridiculous hours. He might be working 90 to 100 hours a week. Same thing with my mom. She would work and work and work. And then, you know, she would be home much more because she would be taking care of us, like my brother and I, and things like that. And by doing that, you know, you're literally living the quality of what things should be and instilling that into your own children. But today, things are different. You know, when I started teaching in the public school system, your eyes really open really wide when you see, you know, you see kids who they have zero resources, literally don't have money to eat lunch. You know, like I get so many good kids who, like, they have the ability to be involved in so many different projects, but, you know, depending on where they live or, you know, the resources are not there. And, you know, unfortunately, and you can really see it with whenever something happens, like any kind of like major event, like COVID or a hurricane, but unfortunately, you know, music education usually is the first thing to be cut. And I mean, not only is it the first thing to be cut, but, you know, people just kind of look at it as, well, can't you just put that band back together and be ready next week? I mean, they ask these questions, but if we were to ask those questions, we're not going to let you have English class for 6 months, but in a week from now, can you have that, you know, class ready back for whatever, the leak test or whatever it may be? You know, and, you know, you get various different responses with that.
Well, it's true. And unfortunately, arts education is not valued to the degree that it should. And as you mentioned, if you don't invest in that, then you're depriving all of these potential talents of their contribution to the world, for that matter. Before we close out today, we are going to get a sneak preview of a recording by the Next Generation Jazz Band. So we'll be listening to that next. But I want to thank you again, Jeremy, for joining me today. And really thank you so much for devoting, you know, so much of your time and energy to nurturing one of New Orleans' greatest gifts to the world, jazz.
Absolutely. Thank you. Thanks for having us.
WHIV 102.3 FM.
Living a good life.